dear listeners, and welcome back to Flight Through Entirety, the only Doctor Who podcast made up of postgraduates talking to each other. We've tried to have it banned. I'm Brendan.
I'm Nathan.
And I feel odd to the touch. I can't be cut with a razor, and I will make your spectrographs look nervous for this story.
And
what story are we doing?
We are doing the lost story. Thank you for that link, Kef McCulloch.
Oh, isn't Kef terrible?
I think he does a decent job of impersonating Dudley.
It's very kind of you to say that.
It's awful. It's terribly inappropriate.
You're talking about
music.
Score.
And after we said goodbye to David Brierley, he's back this week on the video release.
So you're all pretending that this exists in the visual medium, which I'm here to, because this is my story. I got this one. So I'm very happy to share that this canonical reason, referencing Nathan, dictates that this can't be seen because the time scoop cancelled this story from our version of reality. Mm-hmm. As you recall, there's a little story called The Five Doctors that came out not long afterwards, and yet it felt like 20 years after this as far as the distance of narrative and style goes. And you suddenly see Tom and Lalo in a punt, and instantly my yearning, my nostalgia, which is the etymology is two Greek words meaning what?
Pain and home.
Home.
It's like homesickness.
Yeah, I just feel the pain of the loss, really. Pain, yeah. Of them not being here anymore. And so, of course, as we know, that it does exist, but it never actually came out because the Time Lords sort of cancelled it. And so really, really, when Paul McGann goes back and for some reason has to go and get Lalo and K-9 from Gallifrey and then go off and have that adventure. That's probably the real version of this story.
So can we just briefly contextualise this for those who don't know exactly about all of these overlapping versions? So this gets abandoned, we get the location footage done in some of the studio sessions, and then it's abandoned.
Yes, that's correct. So I think we got the location footage and the first studio sessions?
About 70-something minutes of 50-something minutes that
Most of part one exists, but the other parts are about 17, 18 minutes long.
Yeah.
And that gets released on VHS with a script book. Do you remember that?
Yes.
I remember...
An earlier draft of the script book, yes.
I remember bicycling to a video store in DY in order to kind of find it.
And actually, this is a great point, because Todd would like to know about the myriad versions there are of Sharda.
Well, gentlemen, we've arrived in Sharda. My question is this... What version of Sharda did you watch, read, or listen to? I watched the re-edited version from the 1992 video release. I think the location work on this is absolutely stunning. Is this potentially the best six-part Graham Williams story that never was? Well, I'll let you debate the pros and cons of the rest of this story and whether it actually is part of Doctor Who continuity. And I guess I'll see you all in 1980.
So 100 years later, they do a version, and it's actually broadcast on the internet. And it's Big Finish 2003 audio, starring Paul McGann as the Doctor and Romana, who's by now president of Gallifrey. And it's a sort of flash animation thing.
Interweb flash animation, which is always so successful for a whole story.
Yeah, it's a bit rough, actually. Mm. And then there's the novelisation by Gareth Roberts in 2012.
Which is what I used to review this story.
Right.
To me, that is now the canon version of this story.
You know, I think we've had this conversation before, but, I mean, if you're saying this is not canon, are you in some sense saying...
Oh, it is, but it doesn't exist in a visual medium.
But... Anyone who claims that it's not canon seems to me to be saying that this didn't happen in the way that the Horns of Nymon actually happened. Mm. And given that, spoiler alert, neither of them actually happened, it seems like a kind of fruitless argument.
Possibly. But like all discussions of church-like law, we could stay in this for a very long time, couldn't we?
Now,
we could.
I actually have a form to reconcile how this story is canon or what have you. Because that 2003 version, as Richard alluded to earlier, there was a new prologue written for that, performed by Paul McGann, where he goes back and picks up Romana and K-9 and says, we were taken out of time, but we should have had this adventure, so we need to go back and have it again. So in the original TV version of The Five Doctors, that is where the Doctor's taken out of time, Shada doesn't happen for the Fourth Doctor, and the Eighth Doctor has to go back and do it. In the special edition of The Five Doctors, the time scoop puts them back in the punt at the time they left. So you can pick whichever version you like.
Both of them happened.
Both of them happened. My personal opinion of Doctor Who canon and the comics and the audios and the stage plays and whatever else, and this is something I wrote into my first script for Planet Scarrow Audios, everything happened somewhere.
Which is a very Douglas Adams take on it.
Mm. You know, it's like the curator in Day of the Doctor. It's like, does it really matter how he got there?
Yeah.
What's more important is that he's there. Does it really matter if Shada happened and how Shada happened? No, the important thing is that we have about 15 versions of it.
It's kind of funny, but for me, like, before we leave the canon thing, the thing about the TV show that elevates it is that it's the thing that has an audience of millions. It's the thing that it's the format of the show that you can share with other people. You know, you can sit and watch it.
Mm.
Doing an audio or reading a book or a comic is a really solitary experience, but there's something shared. And so our memories of Doctor Who, and because it's so central, we're more likely to have seen a TV show than we are to have read a particular comic or a particular new adventure or a particular BBC book. And so that's the thing that we come back to, I think.
There is one more version we haven't discussed, which is the animated version by Ian Levine.
Oh, yes.
Now, Ian developed this with a view to selling it to Entertain to put out... selling it to BBC Worldwide to put out on the DVD. And apparently the reason that didn't happen was that... sort of Ian did it off his own bat. And the problem was one of contracts, because the way it was produced, if the BBC had bought it, they would have had to pay for it as an original drama, and that wasn't in the budget of the DVD release.
Mm.
And that would have also meant paying the Adams estate for an original drama, even if Adam's widow and his daughter had said, "Look, no, we don't want the money, it's actually a contractual obligation," which is part of the reason it didn't get released. I have seen it. And this is going to lead me into a little story about a very controversial figure in Doctor Who fandom, who is Ian Levine. Ian Levine's animated version features Lala Ward, John Leeson, Daniel Hill, Victoria Burgoyne, and Christopher Neame. All reprising their roles.
Mm.
It doesn't feature Tom. It features a friend of mine, Paul Jones, who's a voice artist and very good Tom impersonator. And Ian invited him round, along with a group of people, to watch a working print of Shada with the animated scenes cut in with the live-action scenes. And So it's live-action where the live-action exists and then animated to cover the bits that don't. Paul said to me, "Look, Ian's asked me if I want to take anyone. I don't think anyone in my family would be interested. I think you'll be interested. And B, I don't know if there's going to be other people I know there. Would you mind coming along?" Because, you know, I know Ian, but Ian's going to be talking to other people
as he's the host. You put on an outfit.
I didn't dress up too fancy. But there wasn't anyone else from the cast there, but there were lots of people, including Waris Hussein.
Wow.
Who was also similarly dressed. It was rather embarrassing for everyone.
I talked to Waris Hussein about directing and said, you know, this was before I was working in television and how interested I was in going into television. And he said how much he'd love to direct an episode of the new series.
Whom do you both have to sleep to?
Well, I'm pretty sure I flirted outrageously with Waris Hussein. And I'm not entirely unsure he didn't flirt with me.
Is there any other level of flirting to be performed other than that?
And so... we sat down and we watched it, and Paul said to me, "After you watch it, I want an honest assessment of what you think of my Tom." And when we got out, I said... "If I'm giving you an honest assessment, Paul, you sound like Season 12 Tom, not Season 17 Tom. That's the only difference."
Oh, such brutalism. Look, I'm devastated. I think the friendship would have ended right there.
Not only that, but Paul had to record his lines sitting across from Lala Ward.
Yeah,
was she poking and making finger gestures and doing the whole thing?
At the end of the first scene, she just looked at him and said, "Freaky."
But they were naked at that stage.
Now, Something I would like to talk about, because Ian Levine gets a lot of flack, and I'm not going to go into the recent things with the missing episodes.
We've talked about Ian before, I love Ian.
Yeah, well, the thing is,
I love what he's done for us.
Ian also showed us that night a DVD special feature that had yet to be released.
I just have no idea where this is going. Go on.
Ian also showed us that night this DVD feature and just asked, please no one mention it because I shouldn't really show it to anyone. We're having such a nice time, blah, blah, blah. And
there's a lot of blood and gore.
And anyway, I left and, you know, no one was said about it. And a few days later, I got a message from Paul saying, look, I'm really sorry to ask you this, but someone told the guy who made the special feature that Ian showed it to us. And Ian has asked me to ask you
but
if
it wasn't
was you.
It
wasn't me. And but Ian said to Paul, quite rightly, he's the only person I'd never met before. Could you ask him? I can't imagine anyone else would have. Oh. And so I said to Paul, no, that's not the case. And then I thought, you know what? Ian Levine, a lot of people see him as this person who will just attack people online. He didn't do that. Yeah. And because at the time I was on Gallifrey Base, which is an online forum, I found him on there and sent him a personal message saying, Ian, I want to assure you that I didn't tell anyone about it, but I also appreciate that I'm the obvious suspect, and I think, you know, it was very considerate of you to ask me through Paul. And I got a really lovely email back from him saying, you know what, you seem like a nice bloke, I didn't think it was you, but thank you for understanding my position. And, yeah, I haven't had any other personal dealings with the man.
When you retrieve my watch, would you please post it back?
Yes. I haven't had any other personal dealings with the man, but that was my experience of Ian Levine.
That's nice.
Mm. It is a lovely story, thank you.
On the topic of that animation, I'll just say Christopher Neame has gone insane, and I won't say anything more. Seek it out and watch it.
The other three versions we haven't mentioned are obviously the light opera, the sculptural version,
Impressionistic dance version.
Oh, yes. I was thinking of the Fuzzyfelt set, actually.
And don't forget Charles K. Feldman's 13-hour film featuring Peter Cushing, Rowan Atkinson, and Trevor Martin.
Yes, that was awesome. Psychedelic.
I
want to
see that.
Recover.
I wish we'd had Rowan Atkinson as a doctor in somewhere of the news.
We do.
Maybe we still will.
As properly. No, Chibnall's casting.
Not just for Christmas.
No. Well, can we talk about how we have sort of said how wonderful this story is, and if you don't know it, I have no idea why you're listening to us, because it will make no sense at all. But it is a beautiful thing, and it is the...
I
should like a hat like that. I should like a hat like that. Don't you get... Isn't it lovely that when Adams is talking about where to write this story, and again, it's a six-day write, but he said there's nowhere else in the world other than Cambridge where you could dress like this villain, panto villain, and not be noticed. And no, have no one really pay you much attention. And okay, it's Skagra, but it's Scaroth, but it's every villain that, you know, we don't want to talk about weakness in Adam's style. It's the same villain every time because he's talking about the overarching mimetic quality of villainy, which is greed, selfishness, narcissism, and suppressed self-loathing, because they don't read enough poetry and they didn't have the joy to go and do humanities at Cambridge and get really filthily drunk and have lovely time meeting girls like Lana Ward.
And Victoria Burgoyne.
Oh, Victoria Burgoyne. She is amazing. And she not only does she look like a Chanel ad, she pictures it if you can see her. And she's on YouTube, isn't it? You can actually see bits of the performance without having to dash out and buy anything, can't you?
I don't know.
I just assume because I've seen it so many times in the other mediums. But yeah, she's absolutely note perfect in this. She's gorgeous. Whereas Chris Parsons, of course, is the Mary Sue of Douglas. He even likes bark like Douglas does. I don't think there's anything wrong with the performance. I just think the character's really wet. But there's so much else going on in this, and there's so many levels. And we can talk about the antecedents, but this is the apotheosis of Douglas's thoughts, Douglas's vision, you know, for his artistic milieu, for his artistic writing, and that it doesn't actually ever get seen is kind of perfect because, well, as we've already said, it's something that you can then go over and interpret, and we spend a lot more time thinking about this story than many others of the 70s because it doesn't have that visceral quality. You don't think so? I've spent a lot of time on this story.
Brace
and going
yourself.
And reading the book.
I really don't like it. Because there is always that question, isn't there? Is this the story that would have redeemed season 17 is this going to be the great William season finale? And I just don't think it is. And I think it...
We haven't seen Skagga actually do anything that mints about in Cambridge.
No. Well, look, I mean, part of it is, I think, due to the presentation, the DVD presentation. And I have to say that I think the novelisation is really much more successful and really enjoyable. Mm. But the TV thing that we have, because Skagra's in the studio blocks that don't get shot, because all of the climactic stuff, all of the big, you know, episode 5 reversals, all of the things on the spaceship aren't there,
yes,
and are just narrated to us by Tom. What we get is the location stuff, which is wonderful and an absolute breath of fresh air after, what, is it 3 successive stories without a frame of location work, yes, at all? So that would have gone some way to redressing the balance and making the season a little bit more interesting. But like, there's a kind of exhaustion about the whole thing. Like, I have to think the monsters would have been terrible. It's beyond...
Are they?
I imagine they have to be. It's beyond tiresome that all of the great geniuses in the entire galaxy are old white men. That's horrifically bad. There's
lots... He's got more important things to talk about. I think he says, we know what villainy is. It's like Goethe Sereni talking about Nazism and Hitler, you know. The Eichmann trials, when she said the base of evil is banality. Evil itself is actually really boring. That's where it comes from. People are bored, that's why they're evil.
In terms of those scientists, remember, they start off as young white men, so at least...
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay, that's
but
true.
But it is surprising...
It was Hannah Arendt, sorry, not Goethe Sereni. Goethe Sereni talked about Albert Speer, Hitler's architect, and Hannah Arendt was the New Yorker correspondent on the Eichmann trials in the early 60s, playing the Judy Garland character from the film. I just had to throw that in.
It is surprising that there aren't at least some women amongst those scientists, because, of course, this is directed by Pennant Roberts.
Yeah,
and we have Victoria Burgoyne.
We have Victoria Burgoyne, but one of Pennant Roberts' things was to take one male role per script and turn it into a woman.
Like Marn.
Like Marn.
Or pantomime. Yeah.
And later on, Preston in Warriors of the Deep.
Yep. And they're all such shining examples, aren't they?
Yeah, thank good. No, I like Marn.
Preston's pretty good as well, like when she's standing on Turlo. That's a fun scene.
She's got great hair.
But we're getting ahead of ourselves. Yeah.
On Turlo, is that the name of this episode?
I quite like the design of the Krags, because we do see one at the end of episode 2, threatening the Doctor.
Yeah, and they would have had CSO overlays and all the rest of it.
They've got their light-up arms.
They do, so do we all. But concentrating on villainy is not the point, and I think Douglas Adams wanted us to think very little of the villainy, because they are rather bland, and they're just there to give us something to do, to act against.
Mm-mm.
But everything that is in this is about Adams' take on the universe, and he's citing, there's all these references, I'll go into it if you want to, the big hits of the day, Hofstadter, you remember Douglas Hofstadter's book, Gödel, Erlebach?
Yeah.
There's notions of that, there's Thomas Pynchon's Gravity's Rainbow, the whole overarching sense of the 60s search for the self and the connection between selves and how that will build a world that needs rescuing, because the current one we had is so indolent and selfish. But he then goes on. I mean, there's references of this of post-Jungian synchronicity. And there's planetary movements of the spheres mentioned in this, as in the little bouncing silver sphere, which is akin to air molecules and moving about. And, you know,
it's not turning into compelling television for me. It does seem like there's a lot of space corridors, and it does seem like there's a lot of faffing about on spaceships. And I have to say, much as I love season 17, I'm a bit sick of that.
Really?
Yeah, a little bit.
It's going meme, is it? I don't get it. I get what you're saying, but I can't get enough of that.
Nathan, I do recommend seek out the animated version.
Do you know, I did try to watch the animated version, and the animation is really rough, and Paul McGann...
No, not the Paul McGann version. Oh, I mean the Ian Levine animated version.
Yeah, the Paul McGann one's not much fun.
The Ian Levine version, the animation is about on par with the animation in the Ice Warriors DVD.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. And
so that bad.
Because that's the thing. I found the video version to be a disappointment. You know, as you say, all the big reversals and all the big reveals are narrated by Tom, and I would just sit there and try and imagine to myself what that would have looked like. And the Paul McGann version helped me a little with that. But then this version that Ian had animated, it really helps to sell those scenes. And the scenes with Lala and Christopher Neame, despite the fact they were recorded on separate continents because Christopher Neame lives in America now.
Still wearing the cape and
hat. Still wearing the cape and hat.
He wears it in that Voyager episode he's in, doesn't he?
Yeah, and he's in an episode of Babylon 5 as well, playing a very similar role. He's actually playing a psychic police officer. But their scenes are really compelling and really sell this idea of the loss of individualism. Because that is the central idea, that Skagro wants no one to be an individual except himself, and everyone will be his individual self. And that is powerful. And unfortunately, those scenes weren't recorded because we only had the first studio recording block. And they actually rehearsed the second, went to lunch, came back, and the doors to the studio were locked. The industrial action had started while they were at lunch.
Wow.
And the next studio session they could get was a week after broadcast.
Mm.
Was a week after the scheduled broadcast. I don't know if Graham Williams said, look, let's just have a hiatus and then come back with the last six episodes. But yeah, the decision was taken on the 10th of December to finish the season with The Horns of Nymon instead.
There was some story, and I don't know how true it was, that there are conflicting accounts. It's a bit like Nero and the Great Fire of Rome. Some people say that John Nathan Turner did his level best to try and salvage the story.
Yeah, there were two versions.
Yeah, and the other version was... he was happy to let it go and to get an extra two episodes for his first season.
So he was the Fiona Walker all the
time. But we don't know which of those is true. Did he write the Tom Baker linking material for the DVD?
Yes, he did. Yeah.
That's very strange, that. Like, he's narrating it as if he's the doctor or something, and it doesn't really work.
Yeah, I mean, that's the thing. There are people who criticise that and then praise the curator in Day of the Doctor. That's the curator!
It's the curator. There we go. Okay, problem solved. It's canon. Is that where the idea for the curator comes from?
He always felt at home at museums. I had never heard that JNT hadn't wanted to make it. His extra two episodes thing... I had just always heard was him saying, I don't want to do any six-parters. And he also had Barry Letts to back him up, because Barry Letts was incoming as executive producer.
And knew more than anyone else how horrendous six-parters are.
Yeah, yeah. I think when JNT was trying to remount it, he was actually toying with the idea of rescripting it and making it a four-parter.
Yeah, he was
taking all the jokes out, probably.
Taking the jokes out. Scientificating. And I think the only reason it didn't come off was cast availability. And I can't say who wasn't available in particular, but I think some of the guest cast weren't available. And it just became a matter of, well, we can't wait to do this. And we can't have this as a movable feast while we're planning our season story arc. Yeah.
No, it was probably just better to cut the cord, you know?
Yeah, yeah. How much energy can you put into that when you currently don't have workable scripts, which we'll discuss?
Williams was still very proud of this story, and you can say that the genuine embitteredness that came of this cancellation and the exhaustion and finally bring around what he really wanted to do, which would have been his next season had he not shuffled off and said goodbye. You know all about that? Plans for the future?
He had plans for another season.
Yeah, with some interesting stories and a whole new take. No Big Mead. I knew he wasn't going to get Douglas back, but the impression that Douglas left in the series and with the coupling of the Doctor and the Companion in this one was apparently something that he felt was really strong, and the BBC felt was really strong, and they wanted to see it continue.
But this whole thing, like these 3 years, have been this kind of limping towards the finish line all the way through. Mm. You know, these constant stories get cancelled, scripts fall through, there's suddenly no money. Like, I've just been re-listening to some of our season 15 podcasts because I'm kind of tragic and a little bit self-obsessed. You know, that is just this sort of terrible tale of fighting against production problems and having those production problems really clearly visible in what makes it to screen.
Mm.
And so you know, there's flashes of genius through all of this stuff. Season 16 is virtually free of that. Well, there's the Armageddon factor. But here, finally, he succumbs to the production problems in such a way that a whole story just doesn't end up happening. And unfortunately, as we've observed in the last few episodes, this is the story he was saving up to make. Yeah. You know, the previous stories suffer visually and in a budgetary way because he's saving up to make this story.
Yeah,
and so it goes and it takes a whole heap of, like, beautiful location footage, just witty dialogue, all of that sort of stuff with it just goes.
Mm. I've just been reading through my notes, and John Nathan Turner did actually send revised scripts to Pennant Roberts to create two 50-minute episodes out of Sharda.
Oh, okay.
And the only reason it didn't happen was studio space.
Right.
Just like the original.
Yeah, yeah.
And when that happened, Christopher Bidmead actually said, well, look, it's not really in keeping with the tone we're going for now either, so...
Because it's fun!
And, you know, also, with that broadcast date, it would have been screened in the middle of the eSpace trilogy.
Which would have been fantastic.
Imagine the linking material for that!
Oh, God.
Doctor, you've changed out of your clothes. Oh, and we're on an identical version of Cambridge in this green space. Oh, God.
It would have been a lovely holiday special thing, just like the Star Wars holiday special. Can you imagine? Actually, Bea Arthur would have been terrific as Skagra.
Yeah. Just a fan.
She is.
Yeah. It's like, it's a problem. It's not a girl. We needed a girly villain. Look how great Myra.
Oh, yeah, Spyro. She was great.
Yeah.
We just need a Janet Alice back.
Actually, Susan Jamison, she was meant to be a villain in the Pertwee era. She never got to be a villain. Yeah, she had to settle for Mrs. Leather. Whimsy.
Yeah, sorry. She
had to settle for Mrs. Whimsy.
Yeah, she did. Huh?
I don't know who we're talking about now.
In the Hornet's Nest audios, she is Tom's companion, his housekeeper, Mrs. Whimsy. Right.
We have met her. We've talked about her before, I think.
They're not very good, but are they?
They get better in the third season when they're more full cast.
Oh, God, they did three seasons?
They did three seasons.
Is that Paul Mars?
Paul Mars. And you get David Troughton in playing the second Doctor. In the third season.
He refused to ever do that. Oh, it wasn't him. It was BF who refused to cast him.
Well, no, because BF do cast him. I think there is a conceit in the story as to why he sounds different.
Yeah.
And I think maybe that's the only way he'll do it.
They're short about the time differential.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
The good thing is this is 1979 and Patrick Troughton's not dead yet. Seems a good time to talk about the rest of the cast. We've already praised Victoria Burgoyne. It was her first telly, and she does remarkably well.
Referencing herself, Burgoyne, as she goes.
I hate that outfit. I hate her hair. She lets her hair down, I think, and then starts to look more human and stuff.
Yeah.
I don't think it's that flattering an outfit.
Perfect 70s cool. I think love what she's
doing. Well, you see, that's the thing. You know, Lala is very glam because she's going out on a punt. Claire's a scientist. So Claire is wearing something practical and something safe for the lab. That's why she's got her hair tied back.
Mm.
And that's why she's wearing, quote-unquote, sensible clothes.
Mm-hmm.
Daniel, you don't mess about with a spectrograph with your lallies all langing down and your hair and your eye are all in a mess, do you?
No, well, fair enough. I don't.
And she has that wonderful bit towards the end of the story where the Doctor says, ask me who Sally Aven is, and because she's got the Professor's memory, oh, well, now he was a great criminal in prison century. She does it so perfectly in that you know it's unusual that she's saying it, but she's still perfectly comfortable saying it. And she's got that beautiful scene with the Professor did something to me, did something to my mind. Which, yes, you can interpret that as innuendo, but she plays it very well in that she's slightly disturbed by it, but she's not terrified and not screaming about it. You know,
she's a scientist. It's an interesting thing that happened.
Yeah.
She's quite good with the Professor, too, in those scenes.
Yes.
That's quite fun.
Our lovely Dennis Perry. We think he's pretty good, don't we?
He is good. He is terrific. Mm. Yeah.
Pennant would bring him back in a few years as an android. Yeah, oh no, he's great. And, okay, you know what, the two lumps no sugar stuff does start to wear a bit thin.
I made sense of that once, but now I can't remember how I worked it out. There is a logic in it somewhere. Maybe it's the lumpiness of milk, but, you know.
Sorry, it is funny. I think it is actually a funny
joke. The whole thing's funny. It has this lovely lightness of touch. It goes along. Okay, it's H.G. Wells' The Door in the Wall. Have you ever read that? It's rooms with a door on it, and that's a... spaceship thing that a time space. It's the same background. I mean, it's not actually that much funner. It doesn't matter about antecedents for this thing, because this is about coming together of lots of different ideas. It works. It works all the way through. And I can't find a dead moment in it.
Once again, you know, Graham Williams is doing something new with the Time Lords, along with Douglas, because Douglas's initial germ of the idea was how do Time Lords punish their criminals? You know, we saw one dematerialized once ages ago. What does that actually mean? What do they do with their own kind who are criminals, etc., etc.? And that was the germ of the idea.
But I like that he's saying that even Time Lords don't know their own full story and don't know how powerful they actually are.
Yes. And, yeah, I love the idea that we've got other Time Lords out in the universe who, like the Doctor, they're not trying to take over planets. Mm. You know, this is a guy who's just decided, oh, I'm going to retire to Earth. Now, the thing is, he has to stay in exile. He has to lay low.
Mm.
But, you know, he hasn't gone off to a craggy moon. He's gone, oh, you know...
I'll
just go off and sit here. And as he says, well, you know, everyone's so discreet. No one's ever going to say, hold on, haven't you been here for 300 years? They'll just think, no, that can't possibly be right. That's very Douglas, you know. Yeah. It's the someone else's problem field.
Yeah, yeah.
Mm.
And that's lovely. And it is such a lovely portrayal. And, you know, he does get cross occasionally, and you do see a little bit of fire in him, like, what have you done with my machine? But most of the time, he's really sweet and really gentle, but it doesn't feel forced.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it is a really likeable performance, and he's a great character.
Mm.
I was looking again at Hofstadter's book and how he talks about the promulgations of mathematics, micro and macro. So, you know, that the clouds in your coffee take the same form as the spirals of the Milky Way. You could say, well, that's a very vain approach, Carly Simon. But but it's exactly what you're saying. The statistically predictable quotient of mass, the action of mass, is yet individually random and pointless. Doctor and Romana win by their randomness, by their apparent pointlessness, by their unpredictability, and by the generation of joy that comes from chaotic intent. The villains are really, and this one as well, I think it's unfair to say that they're dull white men, because there's the dull white men are the ones with the power. That's why he gets them to play villains. The reason we only get Myra Francis as a villain is because it's not what Douglas was trying to tell us. And yes, it makes more fun to watch some variation, but it's because the Nietzschean, I should say, and the narcissistic Aleister Crowley-like similes that are going all through. White guys rule, and they're bloody awful, and they're taking away the money from Cambridge, they're taking away, look what they're doing to the BBC through strike actions, through all the rest of it. Petty power plays are destroying the fun in the world, and they're white blokes who are doing it.
Well, I mean, those
in terrible hats, did we say?
Yeah, yeah. But I mean, I really was referring to those scientists who have had their minds emptied, you know, and are living in the think tank.
But at the same time,
well, they were BBC producers.
At the same time, they've also contributed to this project.
Yeah, yeah.
You know.
Yeah, they're the victims of the...
They're the victims, but at the same time, they've helped him create it.
Yeah.
You know, whereas you've got... Actually, you do have a tension of scientists. So you've got these scientists who've created the brain drain device.
Collective now. Yes, a tension of scientists.
I do like...
It's better than flange, isn't it?
I do like creative nouns like, oh my God, and oh my God, get the thong of spiders. No, I collect huntsmen and put them out in the garden.
And what about spiders?
But meanwhile, on Earth... You
explains
have,
that red cape he's always trotting around every time he goes.
You have Chris and Claire as scientists who are curious scientists.
They
and
are
find
curious.
This immensely powerful object and don't attempt to use it for anything evil. They attempt to research it and learn about it and find out more.
There's so much joy in this.
You know, I don't think that's necessarily an idea that's taken to a massive conclusion.
Well, they're human versions of the Doctor and Romana.
Yes.
In fact, the child versions, I'd like to think that they would be embarking on their own much smaller universe fractal of the Doctor and Romana's journey.
Mm-hmm.
I like how Gareth makes there be a romantic thing between them in the novel.
Didn't you find that in the story? Well, I mean, there is intended to be, but we just don't get it.
It's also underplayed and that kind
English.
Of thing.
It's very Ian and Barbara.
Yeah.
Oh, marvellous. We've actually got... Oh, wow. We've even got 360-degree story arcing here. We go right
back to the beginning.
Yeah. I wouldn't be surprised if Douglas had that in mind.
It's a Time Lord, an old man who's living hidden on Earth, and he's discovered by these two educators.
Oh, my God.
That's crazy, isn't it?
There he is. My goodness me.
Douglas was like a huge Doctor Who fan from the very beginning. Because he shamelessly rips off Dalek Master Plan.
And that was, he said that's one of his earliest memories of
TV.
And putting Jean Marsh on a trampoline is one of his earliest desires.
Yes, well, who hasn't felt like that?
Stephen and Peter Purves, I think, just because, you know, he's got lovely bouncy hair in those days, so he had to do it as well. But why didn't they put Billy on a trampoline for that as well?
He would have broken.
Some of the best toys do. You've seen that washing machine with a brick in it on a trampoline, haven't you?
Yes, I have.
I think that that's Douglas Adams' theory contained in that.
I went to university with a chap. I did this class called Electronic Arts as an elective.
God, that's where your funding money's gone, dear listeners.
And I was sort of doing the most conventional degree in there, in that when we were going around the room, people were saying, oh, you know, I'm doing electronics art in new media. I'm doing flash animation. I'm doing this. They get around to me. Oh, I'm doing a Bachelor of Arts in English. And the tutor literally said, and what else? I'm like, no, just that. What are you doing here? Oh, it's an elective. Oh, okay, right. One of the guys who was, I think he must have been doing some kind of drama degree. The topic was the escape machine, and we had to do something about the escape machine. It could be a video, it could be an animation. I did a short film. His escape machine, he would get broken down appliances and smash them with a sledgehammer. So his final piece was behind plexiglass screens out the back.
I was going to say, there could be a bit of offshooting this. Could be a bit painful.
He was very safe. He wore goggles and everything. Yeah. His final thing was to actually get his mother's old washing machine, which was always breaking down when he was a kid. He bought his mother a new washing machine. So he got the old washing machine. He got the sledgehammer, and just took 5 minutes to take it apart.
He called it Medea, didn't he?
Oh, God, I don't know what he called it, but it was incredibly odd.
Diana Rigg played that on the video, didn't
it? It was incredibly odd. You know, we were undergraduates talking to each other, and they tried to have it there.
Still not very successful. They're kind of like this podcast, really.
There were also the cute pair of skater boys who I could never tell if they were just mates or if they were a couple, who hyperventilated as part of their final presentation for the escape machine and collapsed on the floor.
It was also called Sunburst, you know, when it was first written. That was the acting title of this story.
It was also called The Brain Stealers.
Yes.
Because, that's gripping.
Yeah, well, someone I know was in Cambridge and told me proudly that he was in the background of a scene of Doctor Who and the Brain Stealers. And I think he was there during that pickup, you know, where Skagra picks up the guy outside the pub in Cambridge. And of course, Gareth makes that in his novelisation into a gay pickup. The guy that he picks up is gay and just thinks that he's being picked up by Skagra in his cape and sort of hat. And my friend was very sort of pleased with himself about being in the background of this, and I had to gently inform him that the story had never been made.
I will say, possibly this is a great point to close this out. It has been broadcast. The VHS version has been broadcast by UKTV in Australia during one of their repeat runs.
Wow.
They just broadcast it as
Tom thing.
As an omnibus version.
Oh my goodness, how would that have worked? I've never been able to watch it all the way through. Stop and have blue breaks.
They have ads. They have ads.
Oh.
Yeah. Ooh. But there you go. Australia leading the way for Doctor Who again.
Backwardly, yes.
Well, we're doing everything else backwardly.
Yes.
Right, Jenny Laird Awards, gentlemen.
I have one, and I kind of jumped the gun a little bit, but I do want to mention friend of the podcast, Fiona, who wants to give the Jenny Laird Award to something that we mentioned in Nightmare of Eden at the beginning of episode 4, the incredibly camp, spangly, sequined guards who get variously hugged to death by the mandrels.
Yeah, they do feel like they're from Vidal Sassoon's blow bar. They really are quite magnificent. Thank you, Fiona.
It is awfully sweet how the mandrels just sort of wave their arms at people and they fall over. They're clearly meant to be kind of shredding them with their claws, but
As you say, it's the overpowering scent of that fungal underarm.
That's it. But I think that's almost certainly it. But I do think that the thing that I think is a puzzling creative choice is I don't think Doctor Who is about spaceships, and I don't think it's about science fiction. And here, Doctor Who has turned into a show set on various spaceships, all of which have really kind of unimpressive corridors and things, as you pointed out at the time. And so I think, although I love this season to death, visually it looks exhausted. There's no location footage for 12 consecutive episodes. We're in the studio in really kind of cheaply realized sets, and everything's brown, you know. It's tiresome.
There's that marvelous line from there's that fantastic line from Georgette Heyer and the great Sophie, when she says, "You're doing it too brown." Sophie. And it means over baking. It was an 18th century line that ladies used, allegedly. I do believe she was actually also referring to the William Zero.
Yes.
My puzzling creative choice, it probably won't be a surprise to anyone. It's the decision to bring back Alan Bromley as a director.
Ooh.
Because, yeah, he didn't do a bad job on The Time Warrior.
That's the most heinous thing that's happened this season for you.
Yeah, it really is, because...
That means the rest of it must have been pretty good.
Yeah, you know, because he doesn't do a bad job in terms of what we see on screen. He does a bad job in terms of how he treated the actors.
Yeah, he's a bad job coalescing his performers to care about what they're doing, or be integrated,
But, you know, at this point he was semi-retired.
Semi-comatose.
Graham Williams has been in a constant struggle for all three of his years as producer for quality. We've had Michael Hayes directing. We do have some new directors as well. We have Ken Grieve. We have Kenny McBain, who are both new directors. They do a good job.
Terrific drunks. That really helps too.
And we've got old hands like Christopher Barry.
Yes.
Now, Christopher Barry as an old hand is much better than Alan Bromley as an old hand. I just don't understand why such an inexperienced director, in terms of Doctor Who... He'd only done one other, and that was not a special effects intensive story as we discussed at the time. You know, that was medieval. This had model shots. This had lasers. This had all studio. We really needed someone who was confident with those things. Mm. Now, you could say he's confident with all studio because he worked in the early days of television, but things had moved on so very much. I mean, all that Quantel stuff was pretty much left to the visual effects department. Alan Bromley just kind of said, "Oh, you're doing a thing, you do your thing." You know, there was no consultation between them about, "What do you want this to look like, Alan?" He didn't care. So he didn't care about the special effect visuals. He didn't care about the actors. What did he care about? Why was he there?
The bar.
Paycheck.
And this is something I forgot to mention during Nightmare of Eden, so I'll mention it now because it is relevant. The crew... all went out and had these t-shirts made afterwards.
Bring back Billy Hartnell.
No, but the makeup designer, Joan Stribling, still has her t-shirt, and it's based on one of the final lines of the serial, and the t-shirt is purple with big gold letters, "I'm glad the nightmare is over."
Oh, wow.
But yeah, that's my award. Not necessarily Alan Bromley himself, but just the decision...
Well, don't worry, he's dead now.
I know, but still. The choice to have him in there.
Yeah.
I don't understand.
Yeah. I'm amazed that Graham Williams was still able to breathe by the end of this season.
Yeah. I think that's absolutely true. It's just been three really horrifically difficult years, you know.
My puzzling creative choice is the BBC Boffins, but I get where they're coming from. I think my choice would simply be really the state of anarchy in the UK that's led to this. But I know it's a weak point, isn't it? But I would have loved Douglas and Williams to have continued on. I know that Adams wasn't going to stay for the next season, but they were putting together where this was going to go, and they were looking at arcing this, because it's one of the few shows where you can do that.
Yes.
Back in the day, there was Upstairs, Downstairs, but you know, this could do it anywhere. So yeah, they got it. They were both really clever men. And we underestimate, we don't always give credit to just how much of creative work Williams was doing in this season. He wrote most of the things that we're seeing on here. He wrote a lot of City of Death. a lot of Sharda. Yeah, a lot of the things that we really love. I think my personal creative choice would go to the heads, to McDonald and all the others for doing what they're about to do. I don't find many flaws in this. I find a lot of triumphs against the almost insurmountable. So I can't say that I agree with both of you and the individual things, but I would also say that they're quite small in the spectrum of it,
yeah.
Because overall I think the puzzling things are the things we don't get to see. We just get the ripple effects of the thoughtlessness and this greed and the selfishness. And of course Douglas was giving us exactly that with his villains all the way through. And they are monodimensional because boring people just are.
I've always enjoyed the Graham Williams era of Doctor Who.
Mm. But as much as
well, now that we've done this, now that we've done Flight Through Entirety through the Graham Williams era, I love it even more.
Yeah.
There are times I've written articles on Doctor Who and analysed Doctor Who, but really, sort of, this podcast is the deepest I've analysed the Graham Williams era. And more than any other era of Doctor Who, even when it goes wrong, you can see what they were trying to do. You know, when
it's thematically proud and fine, isn't it? I mean, you can say that Hinchcliffe era, gosh, it looks so great, and there's so much high and low contrast, there's so much divergence and so much to keep us engaged. But looking from this lovely point of the floaty obelisk, shove up, Todd, it's very stifling in this thing. There's so much to admire of where they wanted to go with it. And as you say, the treatment of the individual, I prefer it.
I think I probably prefer it as well. I think I was quite down on the Hinchcliffe era. And partly I was being contrarian, perhaps. But it's nastier than it needed to be.
Didn't treat the women very well, did it?
Well, the women that were in it, you know, there weren't all that many. It just lacked fun. And this...
You're not going to feed Lalit into a garden composter,
no,
are you?
No, you certainly aren't. This is so witty and so funny. There is a real joy to it. And I just think that's spectacular. That's what Doctor Who needs. Doctor Who doesn't need to be a grim, dark slog through various Nazi-inspired battlefields. Mm. It should be fun.
And you know what? I think as an era as a whole, this is the Doctor Who that makes you think about the ideas it's raising the most. We had some of that in the Pertwee era when Robert Sloman or Mac Hulk would write.
Mm.
You know, there'd be social commentary in those scripts. Didn't really have it in the Hinchcliffe era. The Hinchcliffe era was, there are monsters there, we will kill them.
Mm.
Whereas this, you know, sometimes the monsters aren't monsters and sometimes the nice people are monsters. And sometimes they're painted silver and we wonder how that happened. Mm. Yeah, but
I'm still thinking about that.
I would say, with the exception of Underworld...
She did it herself.
With the exception of Underworld, every Graham Williams story raises ideas that it doesn't answer itself, and it doesn't answer them deliberately because it's inviting you to think about them.
Yeah.
Without saying, now you consider this. And I think the greatest triumph of that is something we referred to ages ago in The Sunmakers, when Terence Dix, who is a great writer, but at that time was pushing out these Doctor Who novelizations really quickly, Terence Dix thinks about the death of Gatherer Hayd and adds something to that. Mm. Because Terence Dix, who, as I say, great writer, but at this point sort of just writing what's on the page, it looks like he's read that and gone, you know what, I think this needs to be commented on.
Mm.
And if you can teach something about writing to one of Doctor Who's greatest writers, that's a job well done. Picks of the week.
These are all things that we've mentioned. I've got three, and they are basically the novelisation of City of Death by James Goss, the novelisation of Sharda by Gareth Roberts, and the respective audiobooks of them, which are read by Lalla Ward. If you've never read them, you really, really ought to. They're just terrific. And I was so delighted by James Goss's City of Death novelisation. I just think it's superb. You need to read it, Richard. It's really good.
I do, I suppose.
Yes. It's really good. And I guess the other pick is License Denied, which we've mentioned a couple of times. That's by Paul Cornell, who once named a character after me in A New Adventure. And it's a whole heap of stuff from fanzines and things, but it includes two really important articles that we've cited about the Williams era. It's well worth a read.
It's a lovely thing. Speaking of novels about naughty art thefts and things, watching this again, and indeed reading the Sharda book, took me back to, through Gareth Roberts, to someone who I think must have been, if not known by, and I haven't checked whether Douglas Adams and Kirill Bonfiglioli, the British writer, were mates, but they're certainly very similar people, just working slightly different mediums. Kirill Bonfiglioli is a British writer who wrote the Mordecai trilogy. He's a, it's about, as he said, this is not autobiographical. It's about some other portly, dissolute, immoral, middle-aged art dealer who really doesn't care about anything but having a great deal of fun. They're terrific books. And they feel like Douglas Adams for naughty grown-ups. They can get very dark. They're pretty much thrillers and chase books and crime novels, but they're also hilarious. And when they're funny, they're pure Douglas Adams. Unfortunately, the writer drank himself to an early death. So in a couple of the best books, there have been chapters written by others, and it really clangs. But that's a very Douglas Adams, Graham Williams experience as well. So, yes, I'll include him in the... Well, Nathan will kindly include him in the show notes. But if you wanted to read more of the feel of this season, but maybe for people more your own age now and still just be a part of this for a bit longer, I really recommend this fellow. There's not a lot to read. He didn't publish very much, so.
Fantastic.
My pick is Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency.
How did we not mention that?
Because so, we are so seamless.
I think we may have alluded to it earlier, yeah. But about 10 years afterwards, late 80s,
yeah.
Douglas Adams, you know, flush with success after Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, wrote two books, Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency and The Long Dark Tea Time of the Soul.
Yes.
Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency uses a lot of elements from Sharda and a few elements from City of Death, including the character of Chronotus and the fact he's got a time machine and what have you. I certainly recommend the first book if you've enjoyed this season. It's very in keeping with the tone. The second book is more its own thing.
I like the second book a lot.
The second book's good as well. It's just quite a different beast.
Yeah, yeah.
Dirk Gently has a very interesting life at the moment because there was a run of 4 episodes of a TV series on BBC Four a few years ago. They're very good, but they expunge some of the more fantastical elements.
Right.
But they're a very good thing in their own right. It's Stephen Mangan as Dirk Gently, Richard Boyd as Macduff, and Kate Beckinsale as Susan.
Right.
But yeah, I do recommend this book. The books are, they're very Douglas, but they're also very different from Hitchhikers, because Hitchhikers, of course, goes off on the tangent because it's got the device of the book. Whereas Dirk Gently, while it is a confusing narrative because it's Douglas Adams, it's still much easier to follow. And if you've ever found that you've tried reading Hitchhikers and you can't get your head into it, give Dirk Gently a try. Because there will be things that happen in it where you go, I don't see where this is going. By the time you get to the last page, you'll understand exactly where it was. It's incredibly rewarding.
It's like a puzzle box. It's really, really carefully plotted.
There has also been a very good radio adaptation by Dirk Maggs, who was responsible for the tertiary, quaternary, and quintessential phases of The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. But I recommend starting with the book, Dirk Gently's Holistic Detective Agency. Well, we come to the end of season 17, and you know what? For the first time at the end of an era, I feel quite sad to be saying goodbye to Graham Williams.
I do.
We will be going into a brave new world as we touch down on Brighton Beach for the Leisure Hive, and you may find more changes next season as well. Todd will be back for the Leisure Hive, and Richard will be back possibly when you least expect him.
Because I don't know yet either.
Until then, please check us out online, flightthroughentirety.com, flightthroughentirety on Facebook and iTunes, and FTE Podcast on Twitter, and go ahead and share us around with everyone you know and love as well. We'd love to have some new listeners. And over on Bondfinger, we have an array of commentary podcasts recorded. I don't know where we're up to at this juncture. I will look it up before we do Leisure Hive. Bondfinger.com, Bondfinger on Facebook and iTunes, and Bondfingercast on Twitter.
I like putting them both on at the same time in either ear, and they make a lot more sense. Bonfinger in one ear and us in the other. Yeah. Kind of like the end of the Williams era. Yeah.
And until then, may none of your balls suck your brains out through your forehead. Thank you very much and good night.
Good night.
So I have to let the water out of this then.
That was Fight Through Entirety with Nathan Bottomley, Brendan Jones and Richard Stone. This episode, Chaotic Intent, was recorded on the 6th of February 2016. Flight Through Entirety will return on April the 3rd. They really will publish anything nowadays. Check out the reviews for The Conservative Revolution by Corgi Bernardi. See you in 5 weeks! Sharda, 6th of February.
It's the Sharda.
Yeah, actually. The Sharda.
You know what, Nathan? Do you know what I mean?